Matthew chapter 12, verse 17, that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by Isaiah the prophet, saying, "Behold my servant whom I have chosen, my beloved in whom my soul is well pleased. I will put my spirit upon him, and he shall show judgment to the Gentiles. He shall not strive nor cry, neither shall any man hear his voice in the streets. A bruised reed shall he not break, and smoking flax shall he not quench, till he send forth judgment unto victory. And in his name shall the Gentiles trust." This text has to do with the compassion, the sympathy of the Lord toward his children. A bruised reed shall he not break, and smoking flax shall he not quench. A bruised reed is alive, but it's crippled. A smoking flax has some fire about it, but not much. A smoking flax has just about gone out. That describes a lot of the Lord's people. It describes all of us at one time or another. In spite of our best efforts, from time to time, every last one of us finds himself just teetering on the edge, almost ready to give up. But our compassionate, sympathizing Jesus will not finish breaking that bruised reed. He'll not extinguish that smoking flax. If he would, I would have perished, world without end, years ago. But before I get to that, there's some other things I want to look at. The gospel of grace is a harmonious system. Every part of the doctrine of the Bible is in perfect agreement with every other part. The fact that the contrary system doesn't agree with itself is one of the things that drove me from that doctrine. I began preaching 63 years ago last month with some other people. And I can assure you that when I was preaching with those people, I was as sincerely trying to preach the truth as I ever have since I came to the Old Baptist. I was never entirely satisfied with that doctrine, but it was all I knew, and I did the best I could to preach it. We primitive Baptists should never get the idea that those people who disagree with us are not sincere in the matter. There are many, perhaps most of them, who are just as sincere as any of us ever have been. I had been taught that I was responsible for the eternal destiny of everybody I came in contact with, or everybody I could manage to come in contact with. I wasn't old enough to drive when I started preaching, but I turned 16 before very long, and I was just like any other little 16-year-old boy. I couldn't wait to get my own car. You remember. Now, back in those days, it was safe enough to pick up hitchhikers. I wouldn't dare pick up a hitchhiker now, but it was safe enough back then. And if I saw a hitchhiker, he was fair game. I had a captive audience. I would take him just about anywhere he said he was going. As long as I had gas to get me there and back, or as long as I had money to buy me some more gas to get me back home. And it didn't have to be a hitchhiker. If there was a revival meeting going on anywhere close, I wanted to be there. I wanted to do whatever I could. I remember one revival meeting. It was about 15 miles from where I lived. I'd never been to that church before, but they were having a revival. And I wanted to do whatever I could. And when I got there, I found out that I did know one person there. And he wanted to introduce me to somebody else, and that was all right with me. And when my friend started to introduce me, the man said, "Oh, I already know you." I said, "Well, I don't remember. You're going to have to help me out." And the man told me about a time not long before that. He said, "I was cutting timber on the side of the mountain, wasn't far from where we were. Said I had a crew of men up there working with me. And he said, I saw a car stop down at the foot of the mountain. And he said, a little fella got out, started climbing hand over hand up that mountain. Scared the life out of me," he said. "Thought something was wrong at home, and they had sent for me. But," he said, "no sooner did that little fella get within speaking distance of me, he reached out his hand and he wanted to know, 'Brother, are you a Christian?'" Well, I remember the time, a long time before he got me all the way up that mountain. We should never get the idea that those good people out there who disagree with us are any less sincere than we are. Some of us might do well if we had a little bit more of the kind of zeal that some of them have. I was carrying the weight of a dying world on my shoulders, and that's a load nobody can carry. There's no way I can describe how happy I was when I finally discovered what it really means to be saved by grace. It's not mine to say whether I've ever been worth anything to anybody or not. That's not my call to make. Even Paul himself said, "Yea, I judge not mine own self." But involved in that system, I was literally wearing myself out, trying to save sinners from eternal damnation. Whether I've ever been worth anything to anybody or not, I believe that I have the right to say that I'm still wearing myself out. People keep telling me that I'm wearing myself out. And I keep telling them, I'm going to rest after a while. "When are you going to rest?" I tell them, "Well, I'm 79, will be in a few days. I'm counting on maybe being around till I'm 85, but I'm counting on being out of here by then." And then I'm going to get all the rest that I need. as sincere as I was about that system, I was never entirely satisfied with the doctrine. It contradicted itself in too many ways. One of the beauties of the doctrine of grace is that all the parts fit together. Now, we Primitive Baptists don't have seminaries for our preachers, and we don't have any interest in having them. But do you know, without seminaries to train our preachers, our Primitive Baptist preachers are the most logical, the most consistent preachers on the planet. Our doctrine is reasonable. It's logical. It's consistent. It agrees with itself. I love to preach on election and predestination and redemption and regeneration and resurrection. We don't contradict in one sentence what we just said a moment or so before. Very often a preacher will make the comment that salvation is by grace. Salvation is not by work. You cannot work your way into heaven. You're not saved by what you do. And then a moment later he tells us all you have to do is... and he's sincere in it, but he doesn't realize how he's just contradicted himself. I said it a moment ago. I love to preach on election and predestination and redemption and regeneration and resurrection. But do you know there's something I enjoy preaching on? Pardon me, I'll have to visit this glass every now and then. I have a problem with my throat, and that's enough said about that. But anyway, more than I enjoy preaching on election and predestination and redemption and regeneration, more than I enjoy preaching on those, I enjoy preaching about the one who did the electing, the one who did the predestinating, the one who does the regenerating and will one day take care of the resurrection. Sometimes when I make that statement, I can just almost see people thinking, now Harold Hunt, that is a distinction without a difference. But is it really? Is it possible to preach the letter of the gospel and lose sight of the one who is really the focus of the gospel? I've heard some preaching in my time that was logical. It was doctrinally correct. It was convincing. It was clearly explained, totally sound, but for all the life there was in it, for all the fire there was in it, the preacher might as well have been talking about George Washington or Napoleon Bonaparte. For that matter, I've done my share of preaching that was doctrinally correct, logically convincing, clearly explained, and yet on that day, for all the fire there was in my preaching that day, I might as well have been talking about Napoleon Bonaparte. When I hear a man preach, I like to think that he's excited. I like to think that he's excited about this subject. I'd like to think that the Lord Jesus Christ means all the world to him. I like to think I like to be convinced by his preaching that he has a close personal relationship with the Lord Jesus Christ. That brings us back to the text. That it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by Esaias the prophet, "Behold my servant whom I have chosen, my beloved in whom my soul is well pleased. I will put my spirit upon him, and he shall show judgment to the Gentiles. He shall not strive nor cry, neither shall any man hear his voice in the streets. A bruised reed shall he not break, and smoking flax shall he not quench, till he send forth judgment unto victory." There's a line in one of our songs that refers to the sympathizing Jesus. I love the sound of those words. The sympathizing Jesus. The Lord is sympathetic to us in our folly. He's sympathetic to us in our weakness. He's sympathetic to us in our deepest needs. He will not break that bruised reed. He'll not quench that smoking flax. I recall once when the Lord was at the pool of Bethesda. Well, actually, I don't remember it. I wasn't there. But you know, when you read this book regularly, prayerfully, the very literary style of the Bible leaves you feeling like you were there. It leaves you feeling like you were an eyewitness. Did you ever find yourself, especially reading in the Psalms, the prayers of David, do you ever find yourself talking back to him saying, "David, I know how you feel"? You hear David saying things like, "Is his mercy clean gone forever?" And you say, "David, I've been there, I've done that, I'm there right now." They're sympathizing, our sympathizing Jesus. John chapter 5, verse 5. "And a certain man was there, which had an infirmity 38 years. When the Lord saw him lie, and knew that he had been now a long time in that case, he saith unto him, Wilt thou be made whole? The impotent man answered him, Sir, I have no man when the water is troubled to put me into the pool. But while I'm coming, another steppeth down before him. Jesus saith unto him, rise up and walk. And immediately the man was made whole and took up his bed and walked. And on the same day was the Sabbath." We often make the comment that we are not capable of fully comprehending the majesty of the Lord. And that's true. The very heaven of heavens cannot contain him. But it's also true that you and I are not able to fully comprehend the compassion, the sympathy of the Lord toward his people. If you have ever seen anybody in distress and your heart was touched and you wanted to reach out and you wanted to do something to help, and your heart is just stirred within you, you can be sure that the sympathy, the compassion you feel for that person is only the faintest reflection of the compassion there is in the Lord Jesus Christ. Paul said, "For we have not an high priest which cannot be touched with the feeling of our infirmities." He is touched with the feeling of our infirmities. I enjoy a story I read not long ago about a little boy that went to a pet shop. He wanted to buy a little puppy dog. And he went back and store and he found the dog that he wanted. Went to the clerk and asked how much it was, and it was more money than he had. And he said, I'll be back. I want that dog. And the clerk says, well, you'll have to hurry because those dogs are going quick. He says, oh, no, no, no. He says, that's my dog. He'll wait for me. And the clerk tells him again, well, you better hurry. They're going quick. And the little boy raked leaves and he cut grass and ran errands and did whatever was necessary to get the money to pay for that little puppy dog. He came back and laid all of his money up on the counter, the coins and the crumpled bills and so on. And while the clerk was counting out his money to see if it was enough, he went back in the store and he found that puppy dog, the one that he told the clerk, he'll wait for me. And he brought the scrawniest little crippled pup up there you ever saw. Set it up on the counter. The clerk says, son, you don't want that pup. It's crippled. It can't run. It can't fetch. It can't do any of the things that you want a dog to do. He says, no, no. He says, this is my dog. This is the one I want. This dog, he says, knows how I feel. And the clerk talked with him a while and couldn't convince him otherwise. Finally, kept his money, gave him the pup. And then, as the little boy went out the door, the clerk saw that steel brace on his leg. He says, this is my dog. This dog knows how I feel. You see, the Lord is touched. He's touched with our infirmities. He knows how we feel. Now, as God, he knows everything there is. He knows every atom and every drop of water in this glass. But he became man. And as man, he experientially knows how you feel. For much of the time, that man had lain there for 38 years, waiting, watching for the moving of the water. And then, when the time came, somebody else would step down before him. Can you imagine how disappointing that was? Do you imagine that there was probably not a sadder, more discouraged person in all of Jerusalem than he was? And then the Lord came along. Then our compassionate Jesus showed up on the scene. Jesus saith unto him, rise, take up thy bed and walk. And immediately the man was made whole, took up his bed and walked. I tell you, when our sympathizing Jesus comes along, he makes everything all right. On another occasion, the Lord came to a little village called Nain. And when he came nigh to the gate of the city, behold, there was a dead man carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow. And much people of the city was with her. And when the Lord saw her, he had compassion on her and said unto her, weep not. And he came and touched the bier, and they that bare him stood still. And he said unto the young man, I say unto thee, arise. And he that was dead sat up and began to speak, and he delivered him to his mother. Imagine the plight of that poor widow. She loved this boy. Now he was dead, But it wasn't just that. She was a widow. Her husband was dead. This was her only son. Now he was dead. How was she going to get along? How was she going to live? Now bear in mind that the law of Moses made for provision for those that could not take care of themselves. But Israel in that day had overthrown, they had cast aside the law of Moses, and they had adopted a Christ-hating, God-hating religion called Judaism. And that religion provided ways that a person could avoid providing even for his own parents without incurring any guilt. Moses said, honor thy father and mother. But Judaism said, ye say, if a man shall say to his father or his mother, it is a gift by whatsoever thou mightest be profited by me, he said, he shall be free, and ye suffer him no more to do aught for his father or his mother, making the word of God of none effect through your tradition which ye have delivered, and many such like things ye do. Do you see, if the law of the land made it possible for a person to neglect even his own parents without incurring any guilt, what could she expect from those with whom she had no connection at all? But the Lord came along and he said to this young man, arise. And he that was dead sat up and began to speak. That poor woman went from the very depths of despair to the very mountaintop of rejoicing. Good things happen when our sympathizing Jesus comes along. Another occasion. Well, the Bible is full of them. I don't have time for one, just a very little. Another time, there's a woman which had a spirit of infirmity 18 years and was bowed together and could in no wise lift up herself. And when Jesus saw her, he called her to him and said unto her, woman, thou art loosed from thine infirmity. And he laid his hand on her, and immediately she was made straight and glorified God. I have an idea that if you had been in her shape for 38 years and all of a sudden you were standing up, I have an idea you might have done a little bit of glorifying yourself. But that's not all the story. There's a dark side to it. Verse 14, and the ruler of the synagogue answered with indignation, because that Jesus had healed on the Sabbath day, and said unto the people, there are 6 days in which men ought to work. In them therefore come and be healed, and not on the Sabbath day. The Lord then answered and said, thou hypocrite. The Lord talked straight to him sometimes, didn't he? I never have talked to like that to anybody. But if the Lord said this man was a hypocrite, he knew what he was talking about. He said, thou hypocrite. Doth not each one of you on the Sabbath loose his ox or his ass from the stall and lead him away to watering? And ought not this woman, being a daughter of Abraham, whom Satan hath bound, lo, these 18 years, be loose from this bond on the Sabbath day? There always have been, there always will be, Jewish people who love the Lord much as you do, trying to serve the Lord as clearly as you are with the very little light they have. But you have to make a distinction between the people and the religion, okay? You see, the Lord was very harsh in his judgment of that religion whose purpose was, the purpose of the religion was, to make the commandment of God of none effect. This man would rather that woman would continue to suffer rather than for her to be healed on the Sabbath day. But bear in mind, the Sabbath day is the Lord's day. It belongs to him, and he healed her on his day, and he healed her in his way. I started out saying that there are people in the religions that oppose us who are just as sincere as they can be. But false religion, on the other hand, does have consequences. False religion does have consequences. Enough said on that. Now I want to shift gears, and still got a little time left. I want to shift gears and look at another side of this question. Not only is the Lord sympathetic to us in our needs, he's sympathetic to us in our folly and even in our transgressions. If God dealt with us, if he dealt with you and me according to law, we would have perished long ago. The apostles were good, honorable, decent men, but they were just men. They had the same strengths. They had the same weaknesses that you and I have. And they could fail as miserably as any of us. When they wrote the things they wrote in this book, God would not allow them to make a mistake. You can make a profound argument from even one letter of what they wrote. I don't have time to illustrate that, but you can. You can make a profound argument on just one letter. God inspired what they wrote, and he wouldn't allow them to make a mistake. But they made serious mistakes in their own life and conduct. Being with the Lord, as close to the Lord as they were, having his special attention the way they had, you would think that they would have gotten the point right away, but they didn't. They had trouble. They had trouble learning some of the simplest lessons. In Mark chapter 6, the Lord took 5 loaves and 2 fishes, and he fed 5,000 people. And then just after that, there was a time when they were in the same situation. There was 4,000 this time, nothing to eat. And the disciples panicked. It had been hardly any time since he fed 5,000 with 5 loaves and 2 fishes. And now they're up against the same situation, and they panicked. But the Lord fed those people again. And they took up this time, what was it, 7 baskets full. First time, 12 baskets full. And then another time, not long after that, they were out in a ship and they had forgotten to take bread. It says, neither had they with them in the boat more than 1 loaf. And he charged them saying, take heed, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and of the leaven of Herod. And they reasoned among themselves saying, it is because we have no bread. You'd think they'd remember. You'd think that the Lord, they would remember that the Lord didn't have any trouble of providing the food. But they said, he's put out with us. He's kind of ticked off with us because we forgot to bring bread, and now he's kind of put out with us. These were just men, do you see? And when Jesus knew it, he saith unto them, why reason ye? Because ye have no bread. Perceive ye not, neither remember the 5 loaves of 5,000? How many baskets you took up? The 7 loaves of the 4,000? How many baskets you took up? And he said unto them, how is it that you do not understand? Pardon me. The Lord did not choose these 12 men because they were intellectual giants. You know, for years I used to see these men as if they were made out of porcelain. No, they were just men like you and I are. These were not intellectual giants. These were just ordinary men that God used in an extraordinary way. Let me ask you, if the disciples had that kind of trouble understanding such a simple point in that, do you think that perhaps you and I might be a little more patient with our friends and neighbors when they somehow cannot understand how it is that the Lord can save sinners without our help? You know, Paul said, in meekness instructing those that oppose themselves. You know, the Lord has blessed the old Baptists with a kind of light that the majority of the religious world doesn't have. Do you think that maybe sometimes we old Baptists get a little pharisaical about what we know and kind of look down our nose at those that have not been blessed with the same understanding? You see, if these disciples had so much trouble understanding, I just believe that we could be a little more patient with some of our friends who are not able to recognize some of those beautiful truths that God has allowed us to see. The Lord got put out with them from time to time. Sometimes he would say things like, "Oh, foolish generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I suffer you?" He might very easily have said, "You guys are never going to get it. I think the best thing I can do is just cut you off and find somebody else." I think he could have said that to me a lot of times, quite a few times. But no, our compassionate, sympathizing Jesus sat down with them and explained it to them one more time. The Lord was patient with them when they jockeyed for position. One time when he came to Capernaum, when they were come into the house, the Lord asked them, "What was it that ye disputed among yourselves by the way?" But they held their peace. They didn't want to answer that question. But they held their peace, for by the way, they had disputed among themselves who should be the greatest. Can you imagine 12 preachers, and I'm talking about the apostles. Can you imagine 12 preachers walking along? They thought just out of earshot of the Lord, but they weren't. They could have been a mile away and he'd still known what they said. Can you imagine these preachers walking along and one of them says, "I believe I've qualified for a higher place in the kingdom than you guys, and here's my reason." And can you imagine another one speaking up and saying, "No, I don't think that's right. I believe I'm entitled to more authority than you are, and here's my reason." Can you imagine preachers talking like that? I've never heard any of my brethren say anything like that. We might think it. Might think it, but these folks said it out loud. One then another thought, "Oh, we're going to have a higher place." But the Lord sat down, called them to him, said, "If any man desire to be first of all, the same shall be last of all and servant of all." And he took a child and set him in the midst of them and said unto them, "Whosoever shall receive one of such children in my name receiveth me. And whosoever shall receive me, receiveth not me, but him that sent me." The surest way to fall in the Lord's service is try to lord it over your brethren. And the surest way to gain the Lord's smiles is to do the best you can to live at the feet of your brethren. Matthew 20 and 20. Then came to him the mother of Zebedee's children with her sons, worshiping him and desiring a certain thing of him. And he said unto her, what wilt thou? Now he knew what they were up to all along. It's kind of, as we say, a rhetorical question. He asked the question in order to what for them to speak up. What wilt thou? And she saith unto him, grant that these my two sons may sit, the one on thy right hand and the other on thy left in thy kingdom. It hadn't been long since the Lord had already rebuked them for wanting the preeminence, and here they come around wanting to sit on either side in his kingdom. Now, what they were really saying was, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to know what they had in mind. They wanted to be made the Lord's lieutenants, and they were saying, now, Lord, if you'll put us in charge, we'll keep this crowd straight. These were not rocket scientists. Can you imagine two men bringing their mama? If they were afraid to ask the question without getting their mama to talk up for them, why do they think that they could handle the job if they got the job? But the Lord was very patient with them, very patient with me. Oh, I look back on my folly, and I blush to think of it. Every now and then, Brother Tidwell already mentioned that I do a little writing. Because I do, every now and then, somebody asks me, Brother Hunt, are you going to write an autobiography? I don't think so. Now, I love to read biographies. I love to read autobiographies. You can't entirely depend on either one. Because if it's a biography, he doesn't know the whole story. And if it's an autobiography, he's not telling, okay? But I look back on my own track record. How very compassionate, how very patient the Lord has been with me. I do thank God. I do thank God for that day that I discovered that salvation is by grace. I'd hate to stand before God and have to give answer for my track record. I'd hate to think that my hope of eternal heaven is based on my track record. If salvation is not by grace, then I'm lost, world without end. And you are too. You are too. One more thought on this and then we're done. The night the Lord was betrayed, the Lord said to Peter, said this day, even in this night, before the cock crow, thou shalt deny me thrice. Peter couldn't believe it. Peter had more self-confidence than that. Peter said, though I should die with thee, yet will I not deny thee. Likewise also said they all. That same night, Judas Iscariot came with a great multitude, with swords and staves and weapons. And when Peter saw what was going down, he drew his sword, waded into that crowd, and he cut off the ear of Malchus, the high priest's servant. I never have believed that was what he intended to do. What he intended? No, that wasn't what he intended to do. Can you imagine in a time like that, he comes up and slices the man's ear off? The man dodged. Peter came at him with that big double-handed sword. He meant to take the man's head off. But the man dodged, and he managed to take off his ear. The Lord told him, put up again thy sword into his place. For all they that take the sword shall perish with the sword. Now Peter was not so naive as to believe that he could whip that whole crowd. Peter truly expected to be dead in just a few moments. When he told the Lord, I'll die with you before I'll deny you, he meant it. And when he drew that sword and waded into that crowd, they were all armed. They came with lanterns and torches and weapons. He expected to be dead in just a moment, but he intended to take as many of that crowd with him as he could before he fell. The Lord made him put the sword away, and all his courage left him. He knew how to fight that way, but how the Lord wanted him to fight, he had no idea how to fight without that sword. But after the Lord was risen, the women went to the tomb. They found it was empty. Do you remember the angel said to the women, said, go tell his brethren and Peter. Peter denied he knew him, cussed and swore, said, I don't even know that man. And yet our compassionate, sympathizing Jesus had compassion on him. Go tell his brethren and Peter. Tell that old rough, smelly fisherman. Tell that man that cussed and swore, said, I don't even know that man. Go tell him. Let Peter be the one of the first to know that I've risen from the dead. Do you believe the Lord was any more compassionate with Peter in his shortcomings than he has been with you? Can you not look back on times in your life that if the Lord had dealt with you according to the law, he'd cut you off and you would have perished long ago? A bruised reed will he not break? You may be that broken, bruised reed. You may at this very moment be that smoking flax that's just about to go out. But the Lord won't break the bruised reed. He won't quench the smoking flax, Brother Tidwell.